Today is June 19th, 2013, and this is episode number 209 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor for TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, dental hygienist. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you would like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com. And, you know, I think the one thing we probably don't explain is most of my ridiculous titles, but there's always sort of a vague reason for them.
Yes, and I'm assuming in this case it's because you actually are the TMS staff dental hygienist as well.
Well, yeah. Exactly. Saves money.
Yeah. Yeah. The first time is kind of awkward, but I got used to the clown nose, and I don't know why I'm supposed to wear that when you're working on my teeth. You totally didn't see me going there, did you?
I didn't, man. You blindsided me. That's pretty awesome. All right. So it's been, last week we had WWDC.
Right.
And that was a big thing. And of course, the entire time we've also had the Apple antitrust trial being pursued by the U.S. Department of Justice.
Correct.
And you and I had talked about that, right? Sort of a meta thing. We weren't ready to yet. We were kind of waiting to see where the trial went. And then today we got some news this morning.
Yeah,
today was
kind of, in my opinion, a big news day in the Apple trial, and that's because we ended up with the Barnes & Noble testimony that basically blew a big hole right through the side of the already tattered case that the Department of Justice had presented.
Yeah,
it's been a rough 3 weeks for the DOJ, I'm thinking.
You know, we're going to get into it. We're going to get into it because what we're doing today is Philip Elmer DeWitt, who writes the Apple 2.0 blog for Fortune magazine. He's been in the courtroom throughout most of this trial.
Yes, almost every single day.
Yeah.
And that's a serious commitment because I've sat in courtrooms for long periods of time. That's just a serious commitment all the way around.
Absolutely it is. And he's been doing a great job. He's been doing been getting some killer coverage. And I think he broke the news this morning on the Barnes & Noble testimony.
Yes, I believe so. And he broke more news later on in the morning too, because kept rolling out. Yeah,
it just kept rolling out, and so we have arranged for him. You know, to be what am I trying to say? He's going to be on the show.
What Brian is saying is, we sent out our goon squad with the dark suits and the black man,
uh-huh.
Philip magically appeared in our studios.
Yes.
We don't ask questions. We just take advantage of situations when they're presented to us.
Exactly. Exactly. So, without further ado, we are going to be interviewing Philip Elmer DeWitt to get his take on the trial and the recent developments. As promised, we have Philip Elmer DeWitt today with us to talk about this case with the DOJ. There's been some interesting news developments today.
There have, yes. Thanks for having me on.
Of course.
Yes, thanks for joining us.
So I just came back from court. The judge, the defense rested today. The plaintiffs, because it's a civil case, rested yesterday, and the judge closed the case, closed all, no more evidence, no more testimony at about 2:30. And then she made some really interesting closing remarks, especially interesting because in a pretrial hearing, she had said that she believed that the government would be able to prove to show by direct evidence that Apple, quote, knowingly participated in and facilitated a conspiracy to raise prices of ebooks. So myself and pretty much everybody else covering this case thought that she had basically, showed her hand, that she thought Apple was going to lose. Couldn't tell whether she, how sincerely she believed that, or whether she was trying to force Apple into a settlement, which is not untypical for a judge with a busy schedule. But when the trial started, it really felt like the deck was stacked against Apple, and Apple's lawyer said as much in his opening argument. But as I watched the trial, and I was there every day but two, it was a 3-week trial that ends tomorrow. It felt to me like her view was shifting. She was less hostile to the government's objection to Apple's objection. She'd been very curt with them, and not curt with the government. There was one point where I made a note of it in my notes that for the first time she asked a clarifying question that was in Apple's favor. So given that the way the trial started and how the pretrial started, it felt significant when at the end of the case today, she thanked both parties for their courtesy and their professionalism, and then she said that she had worked very hard on this case before the trial began. She'd pored over a lot of pretrial documents, and she said, quote, "I thought I had prepared so well. I learned a lot, but you have helped me understand so much more through the evidence." Then she said at the end, I look forward to your summations. It seems to me that the issues have somewhat shifted during the course of the trial. Things change. People have to stay nimble. I'm looking forward to understanding where we are now. Nobody was going to sort of say out loud what they thought that meant. But given what she'd said before the trial started and the way things had seemed to go over the 3 weeks, I think Apple should feel very pleased by what she just said.
That is really, really interesting, and that's a pretty breaking news. Now, as of this recording, have you already filed that with Fortune?
Yeah, I had filed a silly little thing during lunch about how she had said that she'd interrupted a demo of the page turn function, you know, the animation on the iBook app. And she said, it's probably no surprise to anybody here, but I have an iPad. I love my iPad. I've seen this feature. you don't have to demonstrate. So I'd written that little thing up. And then when she wrote that, when she said what she said after lunch, I ran back out to the park outside the courthouse and rewrote the piece with a new headline saying, quote, "The issues have shifted," says the judge in the Apple ebook trial. So there you go.
That is super interesting. Let's look at some of the developments, because my pre-trial opinion writing about this piece was that the government had the wrong target, and that it was Amazon that controlled the market, and it was Amazon that was controlling the market through dumping bestsellers, and it didn't really makes sense to me that the government would be going after Apple and the publishers, considering the fact that Amazon was in the process of destroying the entire industry. Feel free to slap me around. What's your take on that?
I can't disagree with you. I think it's a little odd that nobody had complained to the government about Amazon before this whole thing started. I think if there had been a complaint that Amazon, with a 90% share of the ebook market, the number two or number three biggest physical book retailer with enormous power in this market, was selling product below cost, that if someone had filed that complaint, the Justice Department probably would have had to look at it. But as far as I know, nobody did. So when Amazon complained, they sent a memo to the FTC after, in their words, the publishers ganged up on them. I think my sense is that the Department of Justice looked at the evidence and saw what they thought was pretty clear collusion among the five publishers. They had them going out to dinner together. They had them emailing each other and phoning each other a lot. And based on that, they figured they had an easy case to prove against the publishers for what's called a horizontal agreement to fix prices, which is just a straight out, as they say, per se violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Apple, if you come at it from that perspective, Apple looked like a participant. And I think probably there's no thing this you can do in this world from a blog post to a newspaper headline to a Pulitzer Prize winning series that has Apple in the headline that isn't enhanced by the fact that Apple's sure. in the headline. So I think that they expanded the case to include Apple. They thought that was really smart. But then when the publishers settled, because the publishers are poor and things are not going their way as businesses and they're kind of gasping for air, they didn't have the money to fight the suit, so they all settled without admitting any guilt, paid a total of $164 million in penalties, but for them that was relatively cheap. And then the government was left with a case against Apple. And they'd hoped that Apple would settle, but you know, Tim Cook famously said he thought the case was bizarre. He was being asked to sign something that they hadn't done. And damn it, they were going to fight it. They were going to take them all the way to court. And that's what they did. And they had excellent representation. One of the premier antitrust law firms in the country, Gibson Dunn. And the government, you know, looked pretty shabby by comparison. I wasn't the only one in the court who thought that they were obsessed with trivialities and were missing the really big picture.
What about this incident with, Jeff and I weren't there. We've been covering it from afar. We've been adding our own editorial spin, context, as it were, from what you and some of the other mainstream reporters have been reporting from on the scene. But one of the most bizarre things seemed to be this notion of presenting a draft email without mentioning the fact that it was draft and without mentioning the fact that it wasn't sent. I mean, that just seems like just extraordinarily sloppy and an effort to offer prejudicial testimony.
Well, I feel a little bad about that whole incident because I made such a big deal about it when it first arrived. You know, called it the smoking uh-huh. gun. In fact, I got sort of taken to task for that, and was shown before they showed the court the fact that there were many drafts of that email. I think that my sense was that Apple's lawyers thought that they had caught the government, that they had kind of a gotcha on the government, that the government had tried to pull a fast one on the court. By the time they unveiled the drafts and by the time the judge was through obsessing with this whole thing, the judge and even Eddie Q, the Apple senior vice president, had decided that probably the draft email that Apple kind of thought was had been discarded was in fact the last thing, the last version that Steve Jobs wrote. So it wasn't quite as damaging to the government. The government had presented it as a finished email, and at the end of it, I think the judge came around to thinking that it probably was the last thing that Jobs wrote. But Eddie Q made a strong point that clearly in this series of five drafts, Steve was struggling with how this thing worked, and it was clear he didn't understand it. And at the end, decided not to send the email because, as Q said, Steve never sent an email that he wasn't sure was right. So it was bizarre. It chewed up an awful lot of time in the trial. But in the end, I think it was much ado about nothing. I think the government was presenting it, even if it hadn't been sent, I think if you'd ask them, they'd say, well, we're presenting it as indication of his state of mind, that he really did want, as the email said, to move all retailers to agency, which in the government's mind was evidence that Apple was part of this conspiracy to upend the publishing industry and to do it to Amazon. But Q really disarmed that whole argument, because Q said, yeah, that was my original plan. I figured the only way this is going to work is if all the publishers went from the wholesale model, where Amazon was setting the price below cost, to this agency model where the publishers could set the price and we would just take our 30%, just like the way the App Store works. But the more he thought about it, the more he realized that you could say to the publishers, okay, we want you to move everybody to agency, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Sony, anybody else in the market. But there was no way for him to enforce it. He couldn't force Amazon to adopt that model if it didn't want to.
But the one thing they could enforce was the most favored nation clause.
Yes, and that's when they came up with this brilliant idea, they thought, of the most favored, the MFN, the most favored nation, where if a book was selling for less than on the Apple bookstore, no matter who, Apple had the right to insist that the book be sold for that same lower price on their bookstore.
And still take the 30%.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And the brilliant part about that is that it didn't matter what model anybody used. If Amazon brought a book down to $9.99, Apple could sell it for $9.99, and the publishers would have to swallow. It was the difference between making $13 and making $7 for them on the book sale. It wasn't good for the publishers, but it worked out great for Apple.
Yeah, because at that point, if the publishers had stuck with the wholesale model with Amazon, Amazon would have been losing $3, and Apple would have been making about $2.60.
Yes. But you know, in the beginning, one of the publishers, actually, Macmillan, did use both models for a while, and it actually made sense for them because Amazon was huge. And if they could sell some books on Amazon, even if they made less money on Amazon, the volume was so much bigger. Apple was this new entrant, and they didn't know how big it was going to be. So for several months, they had both models going at once and were actually, you know, got called to the carpet by Apple. You got to lower your price in the iBookstore. You've got them too high. Anyway, the brilliance of the MFN was that for the publishers, it basically, they had no choice once it was clear how big Apple was going to be, but to renegotiate their deals with Amazon. In this famous scene, Macmillan went to Seattle, met with Russ Grandinetti, who was this kind of tough guy who was in charge of the Amazon bookstore, the Kindle bookstore, and gave an ultimatum. He said, either you're going to switch to agency or we're going to withhold all our ebooks for 7 months. Grandinetti threw him out of the office, and by the time the Macmillan guy, Sargent, had flown back to New York, Grandinetti had removed all the buy buttons. I mean, just a naked exercise of Amazon's market power. But when Amazon realized, at least this is the way Grandinetti tells it, when Amazon realized that five of the six biggest publishers were all going to do the same thing, it capitulated and signed the deal with Macmillan and then the other four eventually. There's a sort of conspiracy theory behind that offers an alternative view of that, which was that Amazon wanted all along it much preferred getting 30% than getting than losing money on each sale. So it actually ended up better. The conspiracy theory on the other side was that I think the publishers really believe this, and so did Apple, is that Amazon couldn't keep selling books at a loss forever, and that it was eventually going to say to the publishers, hey, we can't keep doing this. You've been selling your books to us for $13, and we're selling them for $9.99. We want you to sell them to us for $5. And at that point, what little air was left in the book publishing business would have disappeared.
Absolutely. All right. Well, yeah. Jeff, step us through the news today from Barnes & Noble, and then let's get Philip's take on that.
Right. Okay. So for everyone playing along at home, Barnes & Noble, their vice president of digital content, took the stand, and what she said was essentially that they had gone to publishers a few weeks before Apple did and proposed pretty much the same deal, an agency model, and they wanted to have their most favored nation clause so that they wouldn't get undercut on prices. And they were already talking to publishers about doing this because they were losing money because they had to match Amazon's prices. And they knew they couldn't sustain a business model where you lose money on every sale. And I found that very interesting because that kind of goes right in the face of the DOJ case saying that Apple had in essence orchestrated and was the ringleader in this whole conspiracy.
Right. That's precisely it completely undermines the government's case. And I'm wondering, Philip, did the DOJ, were they sloppy and didn't know this, or were they just hoping that Apple wouldn't bring Barnes & Noble to the witness stand?
Well, there's a little thing that's the timing in your narrative there is a little bit off. They were losing money. The sequence was they had put an app on the App Store that was a Barnes & Noble reader, like the Kindle reader on the iPhone, to kind of prime the pump or test the waters. Then a few months later, they brought out the Nook. They were making a few sales from that app and were losing a little bit of money because they were having to match Amazon's $9.99 pricing. And then the Nook took off much better than they thought they were. And what had been a trickle of losses turned into this flood, and it was serious trouble for them. They started talking to the publishers about the agency model a couple of weeks before Eddie Q showed up in New York. And in fact, Eddie Q started, when he got there, started hearing from two of the publishers, what do you think about the agency model, which probably that idea had come from Barnes & Noble. But Q moved much faster than Barnes & Noble did, because he was under this deadline pressure to get the whole thing wrapped up before the January 27th launch of the iPad. And Barnes & Noble didn't actually cut its deals with the publishers with the 30% commission and the MFN and all those other elements that looked so much like Apple's deal until around the same time Apple was getting signatures from the publishers. So it's actually not clear whether Barnes & Noble came up with 30% on their own or whether it was in the air. And the MFN, I think it sounded to me like they came up with the MFN on their own, that it was the idea of price matching was just logical. In fact, there was an economist on the stand today who said that that economic theory would have predicted both exactly what Apple did and exactly what Barnes & Noble did. They were just absolutely following what was in their own interest to do it. And you're right, it did really undercut the government's case. The Apple team was delighted with the Barnes & Noble woman's testimony. Horner was her name. And I think especially because part of the government's case was that Apple, through the publishers, had forced the other retailers, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, to switch to the agency model. And there was this woman from Barnes & Noble saying, nobody forced us to do it. We had to do it to save our company.
And on top of that, they were doing it independently of Apple and had even approached the publishers ahead of Apple.
Yep.
Yeah, fascinating. So again, mischief on the part of the DOJ or incompetence?
I think they dealt themselves a bad hand. They had a strong case against the publishers. They thought they had a case against Apple. They did this enormous amount of legwork building the case. You should have seen. They'd gathered every all. It was like the NSA. They had every phone call made by every publishing CEO, all the Apple people. They had it all, time stamped. They drew these graphs. They had handwritten notes. They had people's calendars. They had all the email. It was just this mountain of evidence. I forget what the number was. It was 700 or 800 pieces of evidence that they'd gathered. Having invested all that legwork, it's hard to walk away from it. And I think they weren't very sophisticated. I could be wrong, and the judge could find against Apple, and we're going to look pretty stupid in a month or so when she comes out with this. But it doesn't feel that way. And Apple's one of the keys to its defense, it seemed to me, was that antitrust law treats horizontal conspiracies between people that compete against each other, like the publishers, and vertical players like retailers, who the Supreme Court has said have to be given some leeway to talk to their suppliers in terms of things like prices, and they have to be able to negotiate contracts with them, and they're allowed to do a certain amount of talking among Apple. One of the government's complaints about Apple was that they went to all the publishers and offered them the same terms. Well, it turned out so did Amazon and so did Barnes & Noble. That's just the way you do business.
In fact, the way you do business. What else would Apple do? Is this some a little bit of ivory toweritis where the attorneys on the DOJ side simply don't understand standard business practices? That doesn't seem possible to me.
Yeah, it's hard to it might be that they just weren't that smart. I'm not sure. They didn't really impress me. I'm going to get in trouble here, but I've seen.
Yeah, it's just between us. No one will know.
No one will know.
The Apple lawyers seemed so smart, and the DOJ lawyers seemed so plodding. And maybe that's all the way it always is. I've seen prosecutors work before, and their approach to the trial was, and they would say this off the record. We've got the facts. Apple claims that we've distorted them and taken them out of context. So we're going to drag the witnesses up one by one, present them with what they said, and prove that we didn't distort anything. And they did that. That's what they did, one by one. But then they would, the kind of things that they saw as inconsistencies. I mean, with Eddie Q, literally, they got hung up on someone had written, maybe Eddie had said that the lawyer had prepared the MFN, and then another time he said was preparing, and they got hung up on the verb tense, which is it, Mr. Q?
Depends on what the definition of is.
Right, right.
So that, all right. So then. Was it last week when the CEO of Penguin was on the stand? And they were on the stand for the DOJ. And their statements, their testimony, did not help the DOJ case at all. And that smacks of sloppy case preparation to me.
I'm trying to remember. Who was the Penguin person?
We can look that up.
I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but his testimony was that Apple had a take-it-or-leave-it attitude towards the whole thing and didn't seem like a real leader.
David Shanks.
We're looking at Shanks. Yeah, yeah. Shanks.
Yeah, David Shanks. Shanks. Yeah, the publishers... although the DOJ called them, they were not. None of them were particularly helpful to the DOJ. I think the strongest. Some of them were not very helpful for either of them. But again, there was a sort of a marked difference between us. How smart they were. Shanks was okay. I think the brightest of them was John Sargent of Macmillan. And Q said that he singled out Macmillan even after the first, you know, greet and meet meetings, as he said, this guy was just a book man. He bled books, and turns out his great grandfather founded Doubleday or something like that.
Then that would make sense.
Q described how he, whenever he did one of these negotiations, and he's done tens of thousands, it turns out, he singles out the leaders. He can tell who's going to be a leader in this and is going to want to be the person who sets the terms, and who's going to be the followers that's going to figure, okay, if I wait till the end, maybe I'll get the best terms, you know? And so he picked out Shanks and the woman. What is her name?
From which company?
Simon and Schuster. It'll come to me later. Anyway, they were. She was kind of the activist, and Sargent was. He was just the clearest. So anyway, the publishers
Caroline Reed
had been they. Yeah, Caroline Reed.
Or Caroline, which is a character. Caroline, isn't it?
Yeah, she was a character. She was very opinionated. These guys had been busted, you know, and they'd been forced to settle with this very team of prosecutors, government guys, for something they didn't feel like they'd done anything wrong, but they didn't have the will to fight it or the money to fight it. So, and they, you know, some of them, and especially Carolyn and John, saw Apple. I think they all saw Apple as someone that was going to save them from a really untenable situation. And they were very excited about the possibility of the iPad, which Q couldn't show them. But he would tell them things like, we're working on something. I'm not going to tell you. He wouldn't even use the word device. But he said, it'll give you a reading experience like you've never seen before. It'll have color. It'll be interactive. You can do sound and video. And, you know, you could sort of feel their editorial lust rising. Oh, God, this is going to be great. I mean, these are publishers that had, you know, back catalogs of children's books and cookbooks and travel books and stuff that was just, you know, dead on the Kindle, that was going to come alive on what they imagined this would be. They were actually disappointed in the end, or within a year, I guess, because Apple, I think there's some dispute about whether they have 17% of the market or 25% is what Q said, but Amazon, you know, it's the first mover. It was there first. Barnes & Noble has got a big physical bookstore. Those are tough players to unseat. I think Amazon now, people agree, has about a 60% of the market, and Apple and Barnes & Noble are battling out for the rest.
Which makes sense.
Anyway, we were talking about the publisher.
It makes sense. I don't think it's a problem for Amazon to be a leader in this industry, but I do think it's a problem when they're dumping books and sucking all the profits out of an industry that I liked. Full disclosure, I'm working on my first novel, but I love reading.
Yeah. We all grew up in readers, or we wouldn't be doing what we do. Amazon saw the below cost sales both as a way to sell the Kindle. Grandin Eddy, the guy in charge, said that he thought that the publishers, their motivation was to slow the sales of the Kindle. He thought that's why they were ganging up on him, as he put it. But then I think the larger picture for Bezos, Jeff Bezos, who's the CEO of Amazon, is that a low-cost book is a way to bring people in who are going to buy furniture and kitchenware and, you know,
right,
perfume and everything else that Amazon is going to get into. You know, his approach has been from the beginning, you know, he's not looking to make short-term profits. He's like the anti-Steve Jobs, who was, you know, always feared that the Holocaust was going to come and he better save some money, you know, for the dark times ahead. Bezos is pouring every penny he makes back into expanding his operation. He's going to take full advantage of first mover, and at some point he will own e-tail and we'll and then he'll raise the price.
Yeah, and won't that be a grand day?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Won't that be a grand day? All right. Well, you know, there was another situation that I was personally asking questions about, and that was Apple bringing Eddie Q back to the stand on Monday. So this would have been after a 3-day break in the testimony aspect of this case. And they spent most of that time. Let me emphasize that. Eddie Q is one of Apple's top executives. He is an extraordinarily, I'm sure all their executives are busy, but he has a lot of things to do. And to break his testimony up over 3 days means he's either traveling more or he's not in the office more or something. You know, there was a significant cost to Apple to have him wait until Monday and be on the witness stand. And then the attorneys spent a lot of that time talking about Steve Jobs' role in the process of developing iBooks. And I wrote in my opinion piece on this that I could understand that if this was a jury case, they're trying to tug on the heartstrings, and you know you wouldn't want to crush Steve Jobs's baby now, would you? But with this being a bench trial and with Judge Coat having such a fantastic reputation, I didn't really understand that strategy. Can you shed any insight?
Well, first of all, I don't think Apple's lawyers wanted to break it up. They would have loved to wrap it all up in one day. It's just the previous witness went long, and then the government took its sweet time with Eddie Q. So Apple's lawyers didn't get to him till the afternoon, I don't think, of that Thursday, and they just couldn't get it all done. Tough nuts. He had to spend the weekend there. He may have gone home. I don't know. As to the use of his time on Monday, the following Monday, I sort of questioned more the amount of time they wasted on those stupid 5 Steve Jobs drafts. I think from what we know now about Judge Coat and how much she loves her iPad, and also the sort of loving detail she went into on the Steve Jobs email, I mean, she really studied those things carefully. She even had a bunch of exhibits shown to see how often Steve signed his emails Steve and how many times he didn't. Like, she was really trying to understand as much as she could about Steve Jobs. So it might not have been a dumb strategy to talk about how many of Steve Jobs' fingerprints were on the iPad, how much he cared about it. Q had testified the week before that he was under extra heavy pressure to get this thing done because he knew that Steve was near the end of his life and that this was something he really cared about. And Eddie really wanted to deliver it for him, and it would have broken his heart not to be able to do it. And then to, all this stuff about, as I wrote, all this stuff about why he chose Teddy Kennedy's book because he grew up with John and Bobby, and he'd followed Eddie's Ted's career, and as I wrote in my piece, sort of dead Kennedys, dead Jobs.
Yeah,
cue the video.
I love that closing. I love that closing, Philip. That was just a beautiful piece of opinion writing, man. That was just fantastic.
Well, thanks.
Really, it really, really stood out to me.
You know.
So anyway, I think it may not have been such a dumb strategy.
Yeah, it makes sense to me that Apple would have Eddie on the stand waxing poetic about Steve, knowing now just how much attention Judge Coat was paying to the details of Steve's life. So it completely makes sense to me. Why not put Eddie on the stand and have him spoon feed all of this information about who Steve is and his passion for the products right to the judge and give her exactly what she's looking for?
Yeah, I think actually Q was the pivotal witness. you know, they had to wait to get to him because he was busy negotiating the iTunes radio deals. So they would have had him earlier in the trial if they could have. But he had to get that wrapped up, do the keynote. Some people thought he kind of rushed through that keynote because he was preoccupied, and then fly him to New York. But what was really key about Eddie Q's testimony was, you know, we'd heard a lot of theorizing about why Apple had done this, especially about why it had moved from the all publishers, all retailers agency to the MFN. And to have Q talk through it, talk through his thinking process at each stage, just made it so clear. It was so logical what he'd done. And he was so persuasive as a witness, and so accomplished as a negotiator, that when he said, yeah, you know, they said that, but I didn't believe them. Because I've been in enough negotiations to know that this is a position they take because they don't want to do something. And, you know, you say, yeah, you know, that's probably right. He's probably right about that. So suddenly a lot of stuff that had seemed murky or it seemed damaging or it seemed bizarre suddenly made a lot of sense. And I think probably whatever problems the government had with pulling this case together, it all just sort of fell apart after Q had been there. And I think I wrote something like, you know, the government had its last best chance and they blew it. Not that they blew it. Maybe they didn't have a chance to begin with, because Q just, they couldn't nail him. And on the contrary, he made all their arguments look a little silly.
So do you think he was very more important persuasive than Teresa Horner?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Q was key. I think Horner, you know, she kind of blew a hole in one of the last remaining arguments, but I thought the case had turned before then. Again, I could look pretty stupid in a month or two. But if I had to bet, I'd bet that Apple has won this thing. And if they don't, I'd double or nothing on the appeals court. And if they don't win that, I'm going all the way with the Supreme Court. I just don't see how, especially with as business-friendly Supreme Court as we have, I don't see how they could possibly apply. This would be the first time, as someone said, I think it was Apple's defense, that the antitrust law, well, first of all, an MFN has never been found illegal. And this would be the first time that antitrust law had been applied to a new entry in a market where someone else had a monopoly share and was selling below cost.
And dumping. You
know, so we're getting back to where he started.
That's what's so frustrating. Yeah, and I tell you, I think Jeff and I will be willing to stand on the stupid stand with you if we end up being wrong, because we've been calling it the same way.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate
you're welcome.
Yeah, so it's going to work out great. But if it doesn't, don't worry, you won't be alone.
All right, so one more question. You mentioned a couple of times that to be polite, you questioned the brightness of the DOJ's attorneys. You know, when I compare this case to the excellent job that David Boies did against Microsoft, it's just a night and day kind of situation. I mean, that case was just, it seems so well put together, and this case against Apple just seems beyond. It's not only shoddy, it's misguided in the first place. And I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, Boies is one of the most brilliant attorneys I've ever seen working. So I'm not surprised. Remind me, did the government win that case?
The government won that case. Where they okay. lost it was in the remedy. The judge...
Yeah.
Microsoft is a convicted antitrust offender. And the judge was so exasperated with the tactics of Microsoft's attorneys that he ended up saying things that an appeals court found prejudicial. They didn't toss out the verdict.
That's right.
They tossed out his remedy, which was to split the company up. And then it was the Bush administration's DOJ completely punted on the appeals process and didn't really try to defend that breaking up.
Yeah. And you have to remember, too, as brilliant as David Boies is, he didn't manage to get Al Gore elected
either. That is a fine point. And he was off the case by the time, clearly, because it was the, you know, when it went to the appeals process, he was off the case.
Yeah. So anyway, it may be significant that there were co-counsels in the government, handling the government case. And the senior co-counsel, Mark Ryan, did not do the opening argument and basically took a backseat to the junior co-counsel, a guy named Larry Buderman. So I'm not sure they actually put their best team forward.
Interesting. What a waste of money.
It sure looks that way, anyhow.
Waste of time and money.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Philip Elmer DeWitt, you have been doing a fantastic job of covering this over at Fortune. We appreciate being able to see as much of the trial as you've shown us, and we very much appreciate your time today explaining things to us.
Yes, and thank you for taking all the time to sit in court day after day and watch this trial.
Well, I got to tell you, those seats are damned hard. I started bringing newspapers too because I appreciate that because it was painful. It was a pain in the butt, literally.
Oh, I understand completely.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and I guess we'll hang up here with Philip, and then you and I can get to the closing stuff, Jeff.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Well, I think that officially makes this the easiest podcast we've ever recorded.
Yeah. All we had to do was wait for the guys in the black suits to show up and toss Philip into the studio.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he did all the work.
Yeah.
He did. Oh, well, speaking of work, hold on. I'll be right back.
Okay. Brian, what are you doing? Brian!
What?
What are you doing?
Oh, I'm building the stand of stupid, just in case we end up needing it a little bit later. I figure we ought to be prepared on this one. You got to build it. You got to build it for three people. You know, it's going to be kind of like one of those Olympic stands. We'll put Philip in the middle, and then you and me will be, just below him.
Yeah. I hope you have extra paint so that when things work out in our favor, which I'm assuming they will, you can paint it real pretty, and it'll be our throne of judgment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just in case. It'll do double duty as our stand of triumph.
Yes, the stand of
and
triumph.
And where are we going to put that? Because, you know, like, we'll put it next to the throne of judgment.
Yes, yes. And if there's not room, just knock down that one wall right over there. It'll go into Dave's office, but whatever. He doesn't use it anyhow.
Well, anyway, it was great having Philip on the show.
It was fantastic.
His insight is fantastic. I honestly love his columns over at Fortune. This trial, to me, you know, I know we said it in the interview, and I'm going to say it again. Even if Apple was guilty of trying to, you know, raise prices, as the DOJ put it, even if that was their intent, the whole thing is just misguided because the ebook market was incredibly dysfunctional and served only, well, I don't know, I guess customers certainly benefited in the short term from the low prices on books, but you know, just in the long run, it's just gonna be a mess, and Amazon was going to be the only winner.
Yeah, and yeah, Amazon ultimately would own the entire ebook market. Well, probably the entire book market, except for some retail, like brick and mortar retail. And at that point, they could do the bait and switch and start raising prices.
Yeah, and don't forget that Amazon has entered the publishing industry too.
Oh, that's right.
So, you know, it's just, listen, Amazon does so many things really, really well. I shop at Amazon. They're affiliate partners with us. It's not that I think the Amazon is evil. It's just this lawsuit didn't make any sense. This lawsuit didn't make any sense, and now that the trial has actually taken place, the DOJ's case is just—it's an embarrassment.
Yeah, I have to agree. On the first day of the trial, when both sides were giving their opening statements, even though I didn't agree with some of what the DOJ was saying as they spun the information in their favor, I still thought at that point maybe they had a chance. But
that, and Philip agreed with you. Philip said that their case seemed pretty strong at first. And so I'm going to assume that I missed something. But when I looked at that big slide deck that they put out, to me, their own evidence was contrary to their arguments. But I'm sure I just missed something because, like I said, you and Philip both seemed to be on the same page.
Yeah, well, you know, we still love you, Brian.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Well, it was really fun having him, and I hope everyone enjoyed it. And we should let's boogie.
Sounds great. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening, and feel free to follow me on Twitter and app.net. My name on both is Jay Gamut.
And you can follow me on Twitter at TMOBrian. That's Brian with a Y, which should not be spelled as Briany. Our content is written by the good people at The Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO. And that's all for this week.
And stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at The Mac Observer.